next on Think, how the dreams we have at the very end of our lives are unlike anything else we experience awake or asleep. We'll spend this hour with hospice doctor Christopher Kerr, who says dying people frequently report dreams or visions that feature long-departed loved ones and feel somehow more real than waking reality. We'll talk about how people facing death find meaning and even hope in those final days, and about what we can do to help a loved one through the process. Our conversation starts after a short break. Is imminent, we may have dreams that are unlike anything else we've ever experienced. Dreams that reconnect us with our past, provide a sense of the meaning of our lives, and reduce our anxiety about what comes next. In short, dreams help us do the work of dying. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Dr. Christopher Kerr is CEO and Chief Medical Officer at Hospice Buffalo, where he uses the tools of medical science to ease patients through their final transition. But he's careful not to let the science of medicine obscure the art of it. He has learned through the years that the emotional and spiritual aspects of dying matter as much as the physical ones to people facing death, and he wants to help us understand how. His book, written with Corinne Martirosian, is called Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. Chris, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you for having me.
This book made me think a lot about the fact that for many people, dying is a process. We think of the process as passive, right, for folks who've made the decision to suspend care designed to prolong their lives. But in your telling, it is a more active thing. So what is the work of dying?
Well, you know, I think our notion of dying has somewhat been obscured by its medicalization. So we view it in terms of organ dysfunction or failure and of obviously impending grief and loss. But there's also an inner experience or subjective experience to dying. And it's more than a biologic phenomenon. It's really the closing of a life. And it's a perspective that naturally draws people inward to reflect on what matters most. And it's a natural process that has very little to do with the physical state. And I think sometimes that gets obscured.
You say it's become easier to live longer and harder to die well. Why is that?
Well, I think we've become progressively more death denying as a culture. And medicine has become progressively more death-defying. You know, we're obviously somewhat of an ageist society, and we don't view even the latter pieces of life as a natural progression, but more something to be overcome. And of course, we can't.
You had an experience early in your career that inspired you to devote yourself, your professional life, to hospice care, but before that, you had lived through your father's death and realized how hurtful it can be when the perspective of people dying is ignored. Will you tell us about that?
Yes. You know, I was 12 when my father passed. And the last time I saw him, he was the night before he died, actually, he was reaching out to me and he was trying to button my shirt. In anticipation, he said, of because we're going to go fishing up north. And which was something we did. We're Canadian, which is something we did every year was our time together. And, you know, it was hard to describe because I knew I was losing him, but I also knew intuitively that wherever he was, it was a place that made him more comfortable than what I was seeing. So he was having an experience that was clearly out of reach to me, but that he was okay. You know, and what happened next was that I was taken out of the room by a priest who was present, which is kind of a thing we do, obviously, with children, is sometimes protect them from things that sometimes may actually be helpful.
Professionally, you realized you had a lot to learn when a colleague at a hospice, a nurse, predicted a patient's death based on something other than his like physical vital signs. Nancy paid attention to what this man you call Tom was dreaming about.
Yeah, it was. So I by disposition had no interest in this area of medicine. I had a MD and a PhD in bench science, and I was a cardiology fellow, and I was just moonlighting on weekends at hospice. And it was during the days of the HIV epidemic, and I was caring for a young man who was dying, and I thought, like doctors do, that my role was to do things. And so I thought he had time, so I wanted to give him things like fluids and antibiotics. And the nurse didn't even look up and said, well, he's dying. And I said, why? And she said, well, because he's seen his deceased mother. And I thought it was the strangest thing I had ever heard. And of course, she turned out to be right. And, you know, this is in 1999. And I quickly realized that how I was approaching the bedside of the dying really didn't align with their needs or where they were at. And my colleagues, mostly nurses and social workers and pastoral care folks, clearly were tuned in to the fact that patients were having a separate journey, an inner experience that was not only comforting, but also meaningful and essentially therapeutic. And not just for them, but for the people who they loved, who were at the bedside.
So you decided to make a career pivot. What happened when you went back and reported this to your colleagues in the cardiology department where you had been working?
It wasn't well received. And actually, it's kind of interesting because, you know, it's funny. When we trained in those days, actually, as residents, we formally signed off of cases when the patient was dying, because we say the worst things that can be said to another human being in need, which is there's nothing more we can do for you. And really what we were saying unintentionally is there's nothing more we can do to you. Hmm. But it was a form of almost institutional abandonment that it was okay that once somebody couldn't be cared for, and we've really lost our roles as comforters, that we were okay stepping aside. So it forced me to kind of reassess where I was at and the role I wanted to play. And it wasn't, you know, people at that time viewed it as a loss of a career and a promise and all those sort of things that you would care for people who had outlived their treatability. So we measured our worth, in essence, as doctors on the outcome, not whether the human needed us. So it was really kind of a perverse way to look at it. But that's basically where I quickly saw what I wanted to do, and I've really never looked back.
How strange from the perspective of a patient. I wonder if some of them feel that they have somehow failed the doctor for failing to get better.
Oh, that's really interesting you say that. We're doing a study on that notion of what happens in that dynamic between patient and doctor, because they often feel they get a diagnosis like cancer and they feel their life is in the hands of this oncologist and we're going to go do this together. And the terms of the relationship, the currency is really on whether you're curative or not. And then you kind of fall off this cliff and it feels like, the terms change.
How are our dreams different around the time that we're dying?
In a number of ways. One is, you know, we use the term dreams, but the patients themselves are telling us all the time that they're really not like dreams. They're very distinct. We'll often hear, I don't normally dream and I don't normally recall. One of the things that happens in the dying process is you start to sleep more. And sleep architecture gets kind of broken up. So you're in and out of states of sleep. We asked patients. So one of the things we did is we attempted to quantify this. So we used a university approved protocol, and we would ask people with a questionnaire every day about their experiences. And one of the questions was to measure reality on a 0 to 10 scale. And by far the number that was closest to being picked was 10. So people felt that it was vivid or virtual or real. So they're very, very distinct.
People tell you over and over that these dreams feel more real than reality. They've told you so many times that you feel like there has to be something to it. Are you able to sort of comprehend what that means?
No, I just know to have reverence for it.
Hmm.
You know, one of the things that we've been very, very careful to do is this whole area is confounded by a number of things. So one, people think obviously these folks are confused, and that's why we went to such lengths to make sure they weren't, and we, you know, ruled out things like confusion, and we videotaped many of our patients, that kind of thing. The other thing people are tempted to do is they view this pre-death state as a keyhole to look into the afterlife. And it goes to questions of spirituality, religiosity, paranormal. And we were really careful. All we were attempting to do in our research we've been doing for over a decade now is really just to capture the words and experience of the patients as best we could and accurately translate it. I guess to answer your question, you're left with more questions than answered, but certainly with a belief that there is something that's happening that's transformative and profoundly real. And it's remarkable that people essentially get made whole towards the end. And there's some very interesting patterns that we see. So as we ask people every day before death about these experiences, and we find as they get closer to dying, the dreams increase in frequency, but on content they change. They start to see more and more of people who they've loved and they've lost. And what's interesting was we looked at what content is more comforting. It's seeing the deceased that gives them the greatest amount of comfort. So there's this built-in mechanism. The closer you get to dying, the more those who you've loved get returned to you, and that gives you the greatest degree of comfort. And the fear of death actually diminishes.
Are there loved ones who say, how dare you include my dear person who is at the end of their life in a study, leave them alone, they have, you know, days or weeks left to live?
Oh, that's really interesting. So when we first attempted to do this work, so that's what the university said. They actually denied the study. One of the most interesting takeaways from our experiences, and particularly with the book, we had not one person decline participation, and we had not one person ask that their name be changed. And they often revealing very, you know, deep secrets of having lived. And what it tells you is something really remarkable, that their concern for self has gone. There's no secondary gain here. Their life is ending. Yet it mattered that they contributed and that they were still heard. Their voices mattered. And I think it's absolutely fascinating that people right up until their the end of their life want to contribute and have something to say. When we did a study where we looked at dying as trauma, and looked at this notion of post-traumatic growth. So this idea that you can have a negative experience, but grow from it. And people who were having these experiences, which is the vast majority of people, were distinct from those who weren't in that they were showed positive post-traumatic growth. In other words, right up until the end, they're learning, they're adapting, they're gaining insight. And it's really this paradox of dying. So you see this physical decline, but psychologically or spiritually, they're still growing. They're still very much present and very much alive.
My guest is Dr. Christopher Kerr. He's CEO and Chief Medical Officer at Hospice Buffalo and author of a new book called Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dr. Christopher Kerr, who is CEO and Chief Medical Officer at Hospice Buffalo and has just published a new book called Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. I want to go back, Chris, to this idea of delusions or hallucinations as compared with kind of visions or dreams. Is there an easy clinical way to tell the difference between something a patient is experiencing as a result of a failing or damaged brain or some drugs that they've been given and something that has deeper meaning to the person experiencing it?
Yeah, they couldn't be more contrasted. So people who are in delirious states have really tangential thinking patterns. They're all over the place. They're not coherent. They're not intact. Typically, they're very agitated. And I think that's probably the biggest difference. So confusion, true confusional states leave people typically distressed or bewildered. The dreams and experiences at the end of life actually are soothing to people. And they're told in ways where they're actually have heightened acuity and insight. They're not garbled. So it's a difference between snakes and bugs flying out of the wall versus having warm recollection of a lost child and remembering conversations. That's the other thing is they're making new memories from this. So delirious patients can't form new memories. These folks will tell you again and again what happened. So it's a powerful imprint. They're cognitively otherwise intact, so they know who they are and where they are and what their setting is. So it's difference of day and night.
It's understandable that loved ones might be confused because sometimes dying people have experiences that are very meaningful to them and don't necessarily make sense to loved ones. Why did your patient Mary start to act in ways that really confused her children?
It was interesting. So Mary was a wonderful woman in her eighth decade of life who was nearing the end of her life, and she had four children. And she was having her children were very open, and they were very plugged into what she was referencing as she came in and out of sleep. They all understood it. But then she started cradle a baby that they didn't see, refer to him by name, Danny, and kind of coo him and kiss him. And they were bewildered because that was a reference they didn't understand. And then what happened was her mother, her sister arrived from out of town, and they told her the story. And she said, well, she filled in the gap. Danny was actually her first child who had been lost, who was stillborn. And so she was kind of returned to that place. And what was clear was that she was comforted. So these were their, you know, this idea that we can't cure the physical wounds. She was at the end of her life, but somewhere in this process, her spiritual wounds were being cared for.
We have an email here from listener Eric who asks if these dreams of the dying have anything to do with DMT, which he says is a tryptamine alkaloid in the brain that causes psychedelic experiences.
No, I get asked that question a lot because I don't know a lot about that research, but that's a drug-induced state that parallels these kind of experiences. You know, I think the distinction is that these people are otherwise fully orientated. So they're not placed into a different level of consciousness, alertness, or awareness otherwise. It's specific to these episodic events.
When you have patients who practice a particular faith or who find God to be a really important part of their life, are they likely to report these end-of-life dreams and experiences sort of relate to religious imagery?
No, actually, one of the, so we've studied, I don't know, 1,400 plus patients. And what's interesting is the near absence of religious reference to symbols, icons, et cetera. Others have noted this. And one interpretation is that although they don't refer to specific representations of faith, the overriding themes are themes of forgiveness and love, which are absolutely consistent with the tenets of faith, so that perhaps they're not as incongruent as it appears. You know, we ask people about their religious beliefs. It gets a little problematic because a lot of people will say, for example, they check off, yes, I'm Catholic, but are they practicing Catholic or, you know, that sort of thing. So it's hard to say. But there's, the truth is that there's very few references to religion.
I would imagine that witnesses to these experiences, loved ones who are hearing their dying loved one talk about a dream or a vision of some kind, can make meaning of them in lots of different ways, that they sort of signify something sort of supernatural happening, or that they are just someone going through an emotional process. Do you have a sense of the source of these things? Is it ultimately within the brain of the person experiencing the dream that this experience originates?
No, I'm a neurobiologist by training, and I think this exists within an abstraction that I don't think that you can define at a cellular or neurochemical level. I think it's more of a question of the mind than it is of the brain, if that makes any sense. So it's less about organicity. It's something else that I can't really define. In terms of the meaning for loved ones, it's profound. We've done two studies of over 750 family members. And it turns out, as you would expect, how you witness somebody dies has enormous implications for how you process loss. And some of these people actually are the most interesting on film. Imagine, for example, you have a husband and wife, and they've been life partners for six decades, and they lost a child. And at the end of the life, that's what your life partner is experiencing, the return of that child. That completely redefines end of life as, you know, is instead of being fearful or emptiness, but has meaning and a return of something. And that very much shapes the bereavement process. There's actually measures of grief processing. And when people, bereaved family members, have witnessed these events, it has positive implications for how they grieve.
We should be clear that this isn't a fully positive, happy process for everyone. People have, you know, they bring baggage to their deathbeds. They have things they feel really bad about. Can you talk about the ways that these dreams function for people who maybe don't feel right with people in their past?
Yeah, I mean, people die as they live. And we all have wounds for having lived. And about 15 to 17% of people have very discomforting dreams. One of the things we got terribly wrong at the beginning is we measured comforture of these dreams. And the mistake is to assume that discomforting dreams aren't meaningful, and when in fact, sometimes they're the most transformative dreams. They bring about some kind of insight or need for forgiveness or need to express love. So they're very, very meaningful. And there's so many examples. You know, we had a gentleman who had horrible PTSD after he survived the invasion of Normandy. This was one of our earlier patients. And, you know, at his deathbed, I think he had survivor's guilt, and he sees himself back on the beach, and his soldiers come and reassure him, and he finally slept for the first time. A mother who had a child who was into drugs and in prison, and her whole identity as a parent was really central to who she was. And in her end of life, her parents returned to her and tell her she was a good mother. So we've seen a lot of remarkable things. So they're not always comforting, but they're very, very meaningful.
What do you try to know about your hospice patients as human beings with whole complex lives before they ended up in your care?
That's a great question. I think the privilege of doing this work is that we're protected in our role. So we get to know our patients as people. And I think what becomes very important is that you're treating the patient in the context of their life. So that means you also have an awareness of what matters to them, what they love, who their family is, because that's what they're actually leaving. So it becomes very, very important to understand that. And the issues that they're wrestling with, you know, our job is to palliate or to relieve symptoms. And those symptoms are often psychogenic or spiritual. They could be existential questions. So One of the problems is we look at a dying patient from a medical lens. We view it in terms of pain and breathlessness and nausea, and those things are real. But I think our charge is to treat the person in totality. So that means getting to know them at a very different level.
Let's go to the phones. We have Stuart on the line in Bartonville. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Hi, is it Dr. Kerr?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I was curious, in the context of the current pandemic and all you hear about respirators and intubation, I'm curious whether you've had any chance to work with dying people who weren't so lucid enough to be able to tell you their dreams, but perhaps they got to the edge of death and were those lucky few who can come off a respirator or someone unrelated to the pandemic, but also came very close to death and had a miraculous reversal in their condition, whether or not you have any reports on dreams from those patients.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, great question. I don't actually, because we're working in hospice, so the people who are dying are truly dying. That whole idea, though, of approaching death or even clinically dying, but then being resuscitated and coming back, is that whole area of near-death experience. I can tell you that qualitatively, they're very different. Although I haven't studied it, at least I have some awareness of it. So these are folks typically who come back and say there was a white light, and they come back with almost a message or a deeper understanding. It's interesting, our patients, we've never had a white light, and we've never heard, people don't come back with revelation. They don't say, hey, I saw this and da da da. Actually, very little is said in the dreams of people who are dying between the dreamer and the person. Instead, there just seems to be this feeling or this understanding or this intuition on something. And if you think about it, they don't come out with questions. They come out more with answers. The time for kind of therapy is over. And they've just come out with an understanding. And I think the near-death people, it's a little different. It often sends them on a real trajectory where they, feel a need to explain the experience and that sort of thing.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You note in the book, Chris, not everyone in the medical profession is comfortable acknowledging this more spiritual or emotional aspect of dying. Why do you think some doctors prefer kind of a more limited view that focuses on the physical deterioration of the body?
You know, I think more and more we become specialized to the point of being spot welders. So we look at, organ function or failure, and we don't see the totality. So care is more fragmented. We're a long way from the day where the doctor knew the patient, the family, the whole life cycle, et cetera. You look at everything from the medical economics, you see and bill based on an interaction of doing, not just sitting at the bedside. So I don't think there's that opportunity. There's not that space. And there's almost discomfiture. We're not okay with the idea that the patients fail our medicine, and so I think there's just a loss. I don't think it's modeled well in education. I think it's the lost art of medicine.
So, what does it look like for you as a hospice doctor to make your rounds and just visit each day with the patients in your care?
Yeah, it's profoundly rewarding in ways that are hard to describe. I think one of the biggest misconceptions is you must think we're depressed or depressing. I think the harder work is on, let's say, the oncology side, where you're having to break that news that somebody has a terminal illness. The patients we see have a very different level of acceptance. And they're much more at peace than people would imagine. But we're very privileged to see the very best in people, particularly on the caregiving side, people who didn't know they had it in them, and find tremendous courage and strength and gestures of love. So, we see remarkable, very humane interactions that we're very privileged to be a part of.
there's a certain branch of like psychology. I think about the Jungians who would sort of apply. They would take the images that appeared in a dream, and there was almost like a chart for interpreting what that meant. You say those symbols do not apply here.
No. And the funny thing is, the patient's not asking for interpretation. I've never seen a patient come out of it and say, "Hey, you know, I saw this. Is this symbolic or metaphoric to this?" That's not what's happening. You know, if you have a patient who's 95 years old and he lost his mother at 5, and he wakes and his experience was it was her voice that he heard, or her touch that he felt, he's not asked. There's no interpretive phase to that. It's just factual to what it is. It was a lived experience to these people. That's what these are. They're more actual happenings. So they're not distant. They're not remote to them. They don't have to go through an interpretive process. They're just what they are.
There's no question for them. The meaning is obvious.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's very interesting. There's almost this editing process. So they tend to exclude people who didn't love or nurture them correctly. And it could be one parent or another. And the people they focus on were instrumental in unconditionally loving and securing them.
My guest is Dr. Christopher Kerr. He's CEO and Chief Medical Officer at Hospice Buffalo and has written a book called Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is CEO and Chief Medical Officer at Hospice Buffalo, Dr. Christopher Kerr. His book is called Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Chris, I think our conversation thus far might have implied that these dreams are happening to dying adults. You've also cared for children and teenagers at the end of their lives. Are their dreams functionally different?
No. Yes, we probably have one of the largest palliative care programs for children. We care for about 100 children a day, and I'm actually their doctor. What was interesting in children is in adults, the it's people they know who've lost, who come back to them that bring so much meaning. And so the question is, what happens with a child? First, they don't have language in and around death often or a sense of mortality, but they also don't know somebody who's died. And as we discuss in the book, a number of the children, though, of course, knew animals that had died. And these children were actually filmed as well. And what's remarkable is they come back and essentially provide the child with the same feeling that they're not alone, that they're secure, that they're loved. And that they're comforted. And the children say this essentially in their own language, that this is what the message was to them.
Have these children, once they arrive in hospice, I would imagine they sort of know what's coming for them. Are their families always honest with them?
No, it's kind of interesting. First of all, they're not in hospice. They often, children rarely make it into hospice for all the obvious reasons. So this isn't a pre-hospice program, but they're terminal. One of the things that's interesting is these experiences, it's not that the parents weren't honest, but they're often, there isn't a need, it seems, to provide the same amount of detail. All the children that we studied actually gained their own understanding. They were self-informed. There was just this understanding. And these dreams, in many cases, played a part in that. They knew because they would make references, "I'm going to be okay," you know, meant that they knew something was going to happen, that I won't be alone. The one young lady had was worried, you know, who am I, what am I without my mother? She was raised by a single parent. And in her dream, her mother's friend who had died, she sees her in her mother's room adjusting the shades.
Hmm.
And so she was again secured. But it was what's fascinating is I always thought I struggled with how was I going to, you know, play that role and guide a child through this. And what was striking was there was little need in that there seemed to be this understanding, and clearly these experiences played a part.
Do you feel pressure, especially when dealing with children, to sort of keep it together? Or do you think it's okay if you are overcome with emotion to let them see that?
Yeah, you know, I think that's something we get wrong. I think we're meant to humanize the interaction, and it's not always necessarily with pain. It's also with humor.
Hmm.
I think it's an unfortunate thing that we have to role play to the point that we sterilize what is fundamentally a human-to-human interaction. And I think that the better parts of the physician often emerge if they let that guard down.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Carolyn calling from Dallas, Texas. Hi, Carolyn.
Hello. I have a question. My mother died about 6 weeks ago. She had a lot of things wrong with her. She was on dialysis, but she was stabilized. She was living in a senior living facility and just dropped dead one day. They found her. I didn't order an autopsy because I knew that, it was either a quick stroke or a quick heart attack. Do you have any inkling what goes through people's minds when it happens to them suddenly?
Thanks for calling, Carolyn, and I am sorry for your loss.
Yeah, I'm very sorry. This is just speculation, but you wonder. You certainly hear of people who had sudden death who appeared to be making gestures or trying to get things in order in advance. Even the expression, my life passed before my eyes, when we have something that brings us near to death. Even George Floyd, his last utterances were he was calling for his mother.
Hmm. Excuse me for interrupting you. His mother had already died.
Yeah, right. I think there's something to it. We all seem to get that when it's on the line that things that matter come to surface, right? Like you're not worried about your taxes or, whether you gotta get your car repaired. The things that are pivotal to us come back to us. So I'm not so sure that that's not experience, but again, it's spectral. But my belief is that there is something there.
Are there things we should be asking our loved ones at the time they're dying that maybe people are hesitant to do?
Yes, it's very interesting. So people vary. You walk into a room and some people immediately tell you about these things. But there's some data that people are reluctant to self-disclose for fear of being ridiculed. So I think it's one of those things that it's important to give people permission to acknowledge. So something to the effect that, it's really common that, at the end of life, people have really intense experiences, usually in the form of dreams, which allows people to acknowledge that. You can actually watch people physically relax and say, oh, yeah, I am. Hmm. So I just, again, creating that space by giving some permission to acknowledge it's important.
All right, back to the phones. We have Sandy calling, also from Dallas. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. I was just going to make a comment that I didn't hear the beginning of the broadcast, but I found it the most satisfying and fulfilling working with not only the people that were leaving this world, but with their families, and especially if they could reconcile any problems they had as they were approaching the death experience. But I loved it. I felt like it was the whole reason I was here on this earth was to be there, to be a midwife for the dying.
Hmm. What a beautiful way to say that, Sandy. Thank you for calling. Do you want to respond to anything there, Chris?
No, I just think it's interesting how this whole work kind of self-selects, and she sounds like one of those people who self-selected to do this work. So it's wonderful.
Are there ways that we can take care of caregivers? Sometimes we know a friend who is, you know, sort of nurturing a parent through the end of their lives, or a spouse. Are there things we can do if we're kind of outside that immediate family circle?
Yeah, I think one of the best things is to protect people to play that role. You know, if you look at the data, it takes enormous physical and often even financial toll to be a caregiver, to pause your life, your responsibilities, and to address it. So I think protecting people, just like we do for young mothers, you know, we know intuitively to do that. I think that's so true with caregivers. And again, depending on your relationships, having that kind of dialogue that allows them to express what it is they're feeling.
Do you know if other cultures around the world sort of got this, the kind of thing that you're writing about, before we have in the United States?
Oh, yeah. So this is very, very important to many cultures throughout time. And it's always been acknowledged. And there are a lot of cultures, for example, it's the way of connecting between lives. So seeing the deceased is a way of bringing connection. It's just a given that they're not gone, but you're connected to them. It's a very important part of a lot of belief systems.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the phones, let's speak with Daniel in Garland, Texas. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. I have a question for the doctor. It seems to me, and I was wondering if it's possible or it's just me, that sometimes people are waiting at the time of death for a relative to arrive or the doctor to give them the news that their time is soon. And then they seem to give up the struggle and just welcome.
Yeah, great observation. It's 100% true. Sometimes we can't figure out how somebody's hanging on and they're waiting for that birth or a graduation or to hear somebody's voice. The best way to describe it is that it's very hard to die if you can't fall asleep. And that just doesn't mean being physically comfortable. It means being at peace psychologically. And the best analogy is if you've been a parent and it's Friday night and your kids are out and they haven't heard that door shut, you can't quite sleep. So part of letting go at the end, that expression everybody uses, is really being able to fall towards a deep sleep, because people die in sleep. But that means relaxing. So that's absolutely true. People have to be kind of put back together or reassured or make sure some milestone is reached. And then they can close their eyes and sleep.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Hospice facilities are not available everywhere in the country. They're not available to everybody simply for financial reasons, that sort of thing. What's the difference between the experience of dying in hospice care at home and dying in a facility set up to sort of shepherd patients through the end of their lives?
Highly individualized. There are people who great wish is to die in their own setting. With their own things, their dog, their people, et cetera. There are other people who actually it's their wish not to die at home because they don't want their loved ones to have that remembrance of that room, that bed. So it's really honoring that person's wish. So, one of the problems with hospice is a bit of a myth that everybody can die at home. Dying for the most part is a fairly natural process, but there are states of suffering that really need that level of attention. They should absolutely come into a facility. One of the problems is that people often make promises to a family member that, you know, I'm going to take care of you and you're going to stay at home. But sometimes that's difficult to forecast, and sometimes the reality is medically they need to be in a facility.
Are there things all of us can do now to sort of begin the process of making sense of our lives, even if we don't expect to leave this world for many years?
You know, I think if you were to listen to we did a paper once on the wisdom of the dying and what they tell us, you know, is fascinating, which is to make amends where amends need to be made, either love or forgiveness, to address regrets, those sort of things. In terms of actually facing the dying process, I think it's very, very important to have things like advanced directives in place. You want the right things to happen, and you don't want your loved ones to be in a position of having to play God, so to speak.
For survivors, I mean, not everyone gets a sort of idealized death, no matter how much everybody might want it and try to make it happen sometimes because they're in physical pain or the nature of the accident or illness that ends their lives. Do you have thoughts for people who know that a loved one died without these kinds of comforting dreams that help them to wrap their lives up at the end?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I don't really. So the question is, so if somebody whose loved one died, but they're not sure how they died, or if they suffered in dying, is that what?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, one of the things we see a lot on the bereavement side is it's phenomenal to me how often people will, the grief gets complicated and they can't get over that issue. I'll give you a case. You know, a man's dying by every measure in a hospital. There's really nothing that can be done. And somebody comes and says, you know, if you're to the spouse, if he fails, do you want him intubated, even though the reality is he's not going to come off the ventilator? And she says no. And then what ends up happening, we see this a lot, that they're left wondering whether they made a decision that hastened death or denied life. And sometimes those things just have to be addressed head on.
Dr. Christopher Kerr is CEO and Chief Medical Officer at Hospice Buffalo. His book is called Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. Chris, thank you so much for making time to speak with us.
Thank you very much.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think, and we have a podcast. You can look it up on any podcast service by searching for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.